So welcome to part two of our podcast, Inside UMiami Medicine, with our guest, Professor Mario Stevenson. And you heard all of his accolades before. He is the director of the HIV and Emerging Infectious Disease Institute at the University of Miami Middle School of Medicine. He's co-director of the Miami Center for AIDS Research. And also he holds the Raymond F. Shinazi and Family Endowed Chair in biomedicine. He is a world-renowned virologist who is an eminent expert on HIV/AIDS, and his work and that of his team has made significant strides in helping us develop a cure for this vexing problem. So, Dr. Stevenson and Mario, we want to pick up where we left off the last time. We talked about the antibody as being that is a promising approach, a work being done right here at the middle school by Dr. Desrosiers and the rest of his team, and of course under your leadership. We're providing a glimmer of hope for a true cure when it comes to HIV/AIDS. We know, as we talked about before, that antiretroviral therapy has been very good at suppressing the virus, or the effects of the virus. But once you stop that, it comes back within 2 weeks, according to our discussion. So now let's talk about this concept of the cure. You introduced the cure. So is it a functional cure? Is it a permanent cure? What are the differences between those two?
There are two cure states that are being pursued in the field right now. The first is a sterilizing cure, very high bar. Sterilizing cure means that the intervention has removed all vestiges of the virus, all the bits of viral genetic information from the infected individual.
Is that what that antibody would do?
Theoretically, no.
Okay.
And the reason is that, so people are trying new technologies like CRISPR-Cas to physically excise the genetic information of the virus from the cell. Now, it's amazing technology.
And the point being that the virus incorporates cells in the cellular DNA, and now you want to go out there, cut that, target that, and take it out.
Yes. Okay. We have to remember that 6% of our genome is ancestral viral DNA elements, retrotransposons, that are representative of past pandemics. So HIV does the same. It replicates by insinuating its genetic information into the DNA of the host cell. So when you get infected, your cells acquire 9 additional genes. So the idea behind a sterilizing cure is to get all of those genetic elements of HIV out using genetic scissors like CRISPR-Cas. Amazing technology, but I think it's to get it to the point where we can remove all vestiges of HIV is going to be an enormous, perhaps insurmountable challenge. And the analogy is, imagine you're in the Netherlands, and there's a beautiful field of tulips, yellow tulips, and there's one red tulip. And basically, without being able to discriminate between the red and yellow, you have to remove all the tulips to get that one red one. And that's the same with HIV. We don't have markers that tell us which of the cells are infected. There's so far, we don't see any differences between an HIV-infected cell that's dormant and an uninfected cell. So CRISPR-Cas has to go into every cell
to find
the ones that are...
To find the culprit.
So that's a sterilizing cure.
Formidable. It's formidable. So that cell is really... A chameleon. So you just disguise yourself and so you can't recognize it.
Absolutely. And that's what makes it a tough opponent. So most people are kind of, that's a pie in the sky. That would be great. But, really, we may not be there yet. So the second option is what we call a functional cure, where the virus has been subjugated. It's in a state now where it can't replicate. You take away antiretroviral therapy, the virus doesn't rebound. The individual can't transmit it onto other people. But the viral genome might still be there, but it might be inactive. So that is what
It's been disabled.
There are a number of strategies like block and lock, which uses small molecules to get that viral genome to an permanently inactive state. Shock and kill, get the virus to wake up so that then the immune system and the drugs can attack the infected cells. So far, they've been underwhelming, the results. The antibody, if it can be delivered stably, like in Dr. Desrosiers' strategy, would always be there so that if any virus was able to reawaken, it would immediately be subjugated by the ever-present antibody forces. Now, one of the arguments that I hear, from HIV-infected individuals as to why they want to be cured, is stigma. Stigma is, I think, what distinguishes HIV from many other diseases is the stigma. Fear of criminalization, fear of being ostracized by your family and by your loved ones, fear of transmitting the virus to someone else. And theoretically, that functional cure also removes the stigma because you're no longer manifesting the effects of being infected. So it's a mindset that's for many of us isn't well appreciated, but stigma is a huge issue with HIV infected individuals, and something that there's no place for.
Understood. Certainly remember some of the negative publicity when athletes discovered that they were positive for HIV/AIDS. Mm-hmm. Yes, so the pressing need for that cure remains. So where are we in terms of that functional cure? How we disable that virus from ever?
Well, we have the main organizations would be the National Institutes of Health that have committed about $150 million to big centers that collaborate to find a cure for HIV, the so-called Delaney Enterprise. And they are all pursuing various strategies, block and lock, shock and kill, boosting the immune system to be more effective at controlling the virus, CRISPR-Cas approaches to excising the virus. And then the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have initiated what's called the Frontiers Program. They're pledging about $400 million over the next decade, $400 to $500 million, to come up with a gene therapy cure for HIV. And, you know, the realization is that the vast majority of people living with HIV are in developing nations. So if we're talking about a cure, we have to think about what is the reality for countries that spend less than $1,000 per individual per year on healthcare. If you want to do a gene therapy to cure them, I mean, really, is that feasible? So what the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have tasked scientists with is gene therapy in a box. Something that is portable, can be done almost like point of care, with a price point that is palatable for those nations. And the timeline, we're talking about 2027 to 2030. Now, when we talk about HIV cure, there's a lot of good spin-offs from that research that can impact other diseases. And so with that realization, there is a parallel track for the Frontiers program of developing a cure for sickle cell disease. So the groups that are working on this will be charged with cross fertilization of ideas between HIV and sickle cell disease to get to the same point, gene therapy in a box for those two diseases. And of course, sickle cell disease is a disease of developing nations and also has a huge impact on morbidity and mortality.
Now, the US government has been very focused on eradicating HIV. President Bush introduced the PEPFAR program, which turned out to be one of the most consequential
decisions
that his administration made, and certainly is largely responsible for some of the vast improvements globally in terms of not only the infectivity but the mortality from HIV/AIDS.
Yes.
And now there's a goal to eradicate it by 2030, 2035. How realistic is that?
We have the tools to get there.
Okay.
So the President Trump initiated the End the HIV Epidemic, EHE, that basically has four foundational principles. The main ones are pre-exposure prophylaxis. In other words, anyone who's at risk of infection takes the same medications that people who are infected take. Truvada, one pill a day. And it's a remarkable intervention. It's actually the most effective healthcare intervention for any disease. For every 8 or 9 individuals you have on pre-exposure prophylaxis, you prevent one HIV infection. Testing. So everyone who's infected gets identified, because right now about 16% of people in Florida who are infected don't know it. And if they don't know they're infected, they still have the possibility of passing the virus on, of suffering the consequences of HIV infection. So that's realistic. The goals, the 2032 goals, it used to be 2030, but I think COVID delayed the timeline. We have the tools to get to ending the HIV epidemic in the US. In other words, bringing the number of infected individuals down by 90%, 95%, something like that. But that is not the cure. That is to basically stop the epidemic, reduce the number of new infections by 95%. Florida, 5 metropolitan areas in Florida have the highest rates of new infection in the US. 5 of the top 20 metropolitan areas for new HIV infections are in Florida. Miami's number one.
And why is that?
Well, it's a perfect storm. We have a large tourist industry, our lifeblood. So a lot of people come from other countries. They party hard. They don't understand the risks.
They're not doing pre-exposure prophylaxis.
They're not doing pre-exposure prophylaxis because the state of Florida has been slow to adopt what other states have used very effectively to get their numbers down. I mean, San Francisco isn't seeing any new HIV infections because of PrEP. They're already there at this EHE target. And then we have a lot of disenfranchised and disadvantaged populations, a lot of minorities who are not fully served by the healthcare enterprise. So healthcare access is a very uneven terrain in Florida. Those things combined, substance use, mental health issues.
But under your leadership, there have been a lot of initiatives taken right here at the Miller School and UHealth to address a lot of those issues, including a mobile van, a mobile clinic, and so forth. Just want to make sure that our audience is aware of the important work that's been doing.
Yeah, and that was a partnership with the commissioners in Miami Beach,
great,
where they have the highest rates of new infection. Dr. DeBlecki Lewis, who's our resident PrEP expert and doing fabulous things to get PrEP to this very vulnerable community, because it's a no-brainer. Get PrEP and half the battle.
Excellent.
Solved.
So I want to go back to a concept that you introduced the last time during our previous podcast. And we talked about how the virus infects CD4 positive cells. And you also talked about the fact that you started off studying myeloid cells and TB because that was the target for them. But lately you've been interested in looking at the virus, HIV, in myeloid cells.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that interest, how it evolved, and why it's relevant, and how does that play in our attempt to find at least a functional cure?
Well, I think many of us in the field have long suspected myeloid cells might be a missing piece of the puzzle in terms of how HIV is able to persist in the face of this amazing antiretroviral suppression. But
because they're hard to penetrate?
because they hide out in places that might the drugs might not reach very effectively, or just because they have characteristics that favour, that actually help the virus to persist, they help the virus to avoid immune detection, and they don't suffer any deleterious consequence of being infected. CD4 T cells, when they get infected, they get killed.
Exactly.
That's why you become immunodeficient. You lose your CD4 population. We've published, and others have published, that myeloid cells actually thrive when they become infected with HIV. The virus
appears
to have a mechanism to extend their longevity.
And so it's to hide inside the...
Exactly.
Okay.
But proving that the virus does hide in individuals who are infected and on antiretroviral cocktails has been a scientific challenge, because people study CD4 T cells because they circulate in the blood. So you can draw blood from someone's arm, you can isolate the CD4 T cells and say, yeah, the virus is active, this is its sequence, whatever. But myeloid cells don't circulate. They're anatomic. They're in the brain. They're called microglial cells. They're in the tissues. The lung, they're called alveolar macrophages. In the liver, they're called Kupffer cells. Very heterogeneous. And so to study these in living subjects, I mean, we can't do a brain biopsy. Liver biopsy is not easy. Then there's a sampling issue. So my lab spent a couple of years developing methods that allow us to interrogate those reservoirs, but non-invasively. And basically, the analogy I can use is, you know, you're driving down the road and there's a kid walking along the sidewalk. It's night. He's on his own. You pull alongside, say, hey, what are you doing out on your own at this time of night? Where are your parents? Where do you live? And takes out a little postcard with his name, address, phone number, and parents' names. We use that same strategy to find out where HIV is coming from, where it's hiding out. Because when HIV leaves a cell, it takes with it the membrane of the cell. It wraps itself in the membrane of the cell. It's an enveloped virus. So theoretically, a virus that came from a myeloid cell has proteins specific to myeloid cells that came from a CD4 T cell. So we can use those as sort of little tags to pull out, fish out the viruses that came from myeloid cells versus T cells. We've done that and we've published it in individuals who are on antiretroviral therapy. If they stop taking the meds and the virus rebounds, some of that viral rebound came from myeloid cells.
Okay.
But we don't know which ones yet. We're trying to refine the methods now to find out if it was it the microglial cells in the brain, probably our prime suspect. Was it the liver? Was it the lung? So we've had a couple of grants to now pursue those different compartments.
And you believe that this will enhance our ability to develop a functional cure?
Well, I hope so. But the more we understand about the interplay between viruses and myeloid cells, the more formidable a challenge it seems to be. Because some of the foundational principles behind the cure strategies for HIV and T cells aren't going to work for myeloid cells.
Okay.
So we may have to rethink some, come up with different strategies to get at that reservoir. But I believe in the creativity of scientists and that someone will figure it out.
So it's great that we are able to not only focus on CD4 positive cells, but also the myeloid cells. So this way we have multiple ways of trying to attack this problem.
Yes.
Which is quite still very vexing. Just shift gear for a little bit. You're part of this interdisciplinary team, part of CIFAR and the Institute, that just received a $3 million grant to study the impact of meth use on HIV progression. So tell us about the goal of this study and where we stand.
Well, meth is...
methamphetamine, just...
Yes, of any agent that's likely to make things worse for HIV.
Why is that?
Because, first of all, individuals who are addicted, the first thing they're going to think about is not their antiretroviral medications, but their meth use. So the level of adherence to antiretrovirals is very low in individuals who are addicted to meth. And so we've got amazing people here at the university, Adam Carrico, Hansel Tooks, who understand those populations and the factors, the things that they deal with deal with day to day that stand in the way of their remaining adherent, and they're driven to making sure that they stay adherent on their antiretroviral medications. But we suspect that meth directly impacts the reservoirs of HIV.
How so?
Because it has an, it can epigenetically modify the host cell repertoire, and that could be the trigger for HIV activation. Now, theoretically, what we're going to look for is whether people who are HIV infected and are on meth have higher levels of reservoir activity, not just in the CD4 T cells, but in the myeloid cells. And the impact of meth is manifest in the brain in terms of the positive effects that you get from meth use. Now, if indeed meth is acting on the reservoirs to increase the level of viral activity, one could theoretically expect that that's acting like a shock and kill stimulus. In other words, if the virus is lying dormant, does the meth get the virus out of dormancy so that then it can be more effectively eliminated? So one potential long-term consequence of our study could be that we see a reduction in the reservoir size in individuals who have been on meth long-term. So that's the sorts of thing we're going to be looking
for. Because it enhances access to the virus.
Exactly.
Right? You can really talk. So that would be fantastic if we can exploit that concept.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, especially, you know, it is a challenge because we're dealing with very, you know, a very vulnerable population. But fortunately, the team has some amazing, you know, experts who can recruit the individuals and keep them in the study.
And the scientists actually do the defining work in the laboratory.
Well, I'm learning that 90% of this effort is actually getting the cohort assembled and keeping the cohort engaged. So I think my job is kind of easy.
But we have a whole lot of experience with that, with the idea exchange.
Yes.
Through Dr. Took's work and so forth. And so the mobile clinic. And so I imagine we have both the tools, the mechanisms, the vehicles, the expertise, just about in every dimension that really should make the Miller School an ideal facility for us to do this type of work.
I think we're now seeing the benefits of how establishing an infrastructure, the IDEA mobile exchange clinic, the mobile clinics that reach out into the community, and investigators, and for example, Adam Carrico in Public Health Sciences and Hansel Tuks, we're now seeing how that can promote interdisciplinary science, because what we're talking about is something that requires the input of epigenetic scientists, Lishan Lovu, behavioral investigator, someone who understands the populations, Hansel Tuks, and the basic science.
This is fascinating. So we've covered a lot of grounds over this past two podcasts. So how would you begin to wrap it all up for our audience in terms of where we've been, where we are now, and what your forecast is for the next 10 years when it comes to finding that functional cure for HIV?
Yeah.
And do you believe it's going to be made right here?
Well, you know, I've been working on HIV since 1984, okay? And I've seen a remarkable renaissance in first of all, what the consequences are for HIV-infected individuals who now essentially have a normal lifespan if they got on the modern medications, where, you know, we've basically slowed down the number of new infections dramatically, but we've still got ways to go. And now our insight into HIV host interaction has gotten to the point where we really are getting a deep understanding of what we'll need to do to cure infection. But in that journey, it's that last mile that's proving to be the toughest. In terms of getting the number of new infections to the EHE, the end HIV epidemic targets, That's because of the health disparities. Most of the new infections are occurring in the Southeast, Florida, Louisiana, Arkansas, South Carolina. Those are still got the highest rates of new infections, Georgia. And then, so science can only do so much. Now we need a great relationship with our healthcare agencies. We need a great relationship with our politicians to make sure that they can provide the support we need to reach into the vulnerable populations and get that last mile. In terms of the cure, if you had asked me, you know, 3-4 years ago, are we ever going to have a cure for HIV? I would have said, not in my lifetime. What I've seen with the monoclonal antibodies from different groups and from the work that's going on here, I'm saying it could be round the corner. There's some serious obstacles, but I think the work that Rhonda Rosie is doing is exactly what the field is looking for. A single shot cure that isn't just for the US and for, you know, for a developed healthcare enterprise, but for where the greatest burden of HIV actually exists in developing nations. So, you know, I'm energized by the work that Ron is doing. I think the obstacles are formidable, but, you know, he's a creative guy, and he and his team, I think, might figure out how to use these remarkable antibodies for a cure.
Well, this is a fantastic place to stop. And of course, we, as the dean, I am excited about the work that you, your team, have been doing, and also the promising avenues for Rhonda Rosier's work, because without question, the millions of people who are infected with this virus want to get rid of that stigma. And I'm glad that in the foreseeable future, University of Miami Miller School of Medicine is going to be able to help them get rid of that stigma to the fine work that you and your team are doing. It's been fantastic talking to you. I think I've learned a whole lot, and I hope that the entire audience that's been listening to this podcast have been enlightened as well. And more importantly, you and your team are bringing hope to a population that desperately needs it. So thank you for your work.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being so engaging. So this has been another edition of Inside U Miami Medicine podcast with the eminent virologist, Dr. Mario Stevenson, director of the HIV and Emerging Infectious Diseases Institute, co-director of the Miami Center for AIDS Research, and the Raymond F. Shinazi and Family Endowed Charity in Bowel Medicine. Thank you so very much, Mario.
Thank you, Dean Ford.